Hello, I'm Michael Williams, Artistic Director of Sydney Writers Festival. I hope you enjoy this conversation from our 2020 podcast series.
Hello everyone, and thanks so much for joining us for this podcast session of the Sydney Writers Festival. My name's Ashley Hay and I'm the editor of Griffith Review. It's my pleasure to be talking with Tony Birch, Jane R. Goodall and Andrew Stafford, three of our contributors to Griffith Review 68, Getting On. We published this edition in May 2020, which has made it an interesting wrangle in terms of events. We're thrilled to be able to bring you this conversation from two points in Brisbane, one in Sydney and one in Melbourne, to wherever you are today. First of all, I'd like to acknowledge the Gadigal of the Eora Nation, the traditional custodians of the land on which these events ordinarily take place, and pay my respects to elders past, present and emerging. I'd also like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land on which I'm joining you. I'm south of the Brisbane River on the land of the Yagara people, and I'd like to acknowledge the elders of this place as well, and to acknowledge the great privilege of gathering together to tell our stories today on a continent that holds millennia of stories and the technologies that allow us to do that. Griffith Review, for those of you who don't know, is a quarterly journal of ideas and good writing. We explore a different theme each 3 months, which makes us a kind of ongoing conversation in a way. We'd love you to join us. You can subscribe or you can find us book by book in your local bookshop. So this 68th edition, Getting On, was themed around ideas of ageing, maturities and mortalities. It featured writing from an extraordinary range of contributors, including Frank Brennan on palliative care, Bianca O'Grady on the science of ageing, Gabby Stroud on the ways we age, the people we lose early, Vicky Lavoe-Harvey on late-blooming ambition, and Helen Garner on the impossibility of not writing, amongst many more. We've got some specific directions to explore with our specific writers today, some new prisms to bring to bear on ideas of maturities and mortalities now that we're in this COVID-19 world. We started commissioning this book more concerned about how the long shadow of the Royal Commission into aged care quality and safety might work in our space, but we found ourselves in the middle of a much bigger and entirely unprecedented conversation about risk and ageing in the space of the pandemic. I think that has to become part of what we talk about today. I think it might be part of where we end up with these three people. So let me introduce you now to the first of our three contributors today, and I'm going to start with Jane R. Goodall, who's Emeritus Professor with the Writing and Society Research Centre at Western Sydney University. Jane specialises in cultural history and the dynamics of cultural change, and she contributes regularly to Inside Story. Her most recent book is The Politics of the Common Good. Jane, thanks so much for being with us for this very late in the piece conversation about Getting On, and also for your very powerful contribution to this edition, which is called Joining Forces, When the Wrath of Age Meets the Passion of Youth. Now, you start with an observation about the lack of public discussion about what it means to be an elder rather than a senior today. And you talk about the importance of elders in terms of sustaining bonds with land and environment. And you ask the question about the role of the elder in a world where culture and location have sort of come significantly adrift in the last couple of hundred years. I wanted to start by putting that question to you, how you see the role of the elder and whether your definition of what an elder might usefully do has changed at all now that we're at this end of 2020 and the particular challenges that it's thrown at us.
That's a lot of questions in one. I'll start with where I was at when I wrote the statement. I mean, as soon as you start to use the word elder from where I am, you have to think, what right do I have to use a word that is now so strongly associated with the Indigenous people of Australia and is so much part of statements we make and invite from the Indigenous people? I'm speaking on Ngunnawal land and would pay my respects to the elders past and present. Now, that is already a very specific statement. Wherever we are in Australia, we acknowledge the elders who are specific to that location. If you are from a migrant tradition, you know, your ancestors came to this country from elsewhere, you're non-Indigenous, in what sense can you be an elder if you're foreign to the land? So that's the first question, and I think it's very big. And we can't stop thinking about that. We need to continue to evolve that question from generation to generation. It's in a different place now from where it was a generation ago and two or three generations before that. So the relationship between being an elder and being identified with land, with a particular part of the land, where the physical experience of your life would have played out, that's something that those of us who are of a migrant culture don't know. But does that mean we can't be elders? What does it mean to be an elder if you don't have that connection to speak from? And if you can't speak with and from the authority of country? In the interview you did with Ruth Ross and Jay Phillips, that they were talking about that. And Ruth talked both about the need to find out what country a person is speaking on. And she also talked about speaking across countries. So there was a sense in which when an elder does a welcome to country, they may be also speaking more broadly across, the whole continent, I guess. So perhaps in the broader spectrum, we might start to find a place for ourselves. To get to the lockdown, perhaps one of the things it's done for us is to connect us a bit more tightly to a locale. Those of us who are lucky to be on the ground and even have some garden have developed a much stronger relationship with the immediate land around us. That's probably made us aware of things we weren't aware of before. We might be observing more closely, changes in the trees, in the sky. But a truly Indigenous relationship with the land, of course, is much deeper and more powerful than that. It goes back through generations. And as you're having that sense of subtle changes, day to day, month to month, seasonal weather changes, if your people are from this place, you have a deep history behind that. You will have been told stories. And there may also be metaphoric meanings attached to and symbolic meanings attached to the environment around you. So that's quite a long answer to your first question. I might stop there and see where you'd like to go from there.
I did want to pick up on the idea of roles and responsibilities, I guess, because one of the spaces that you explore in the book is the boomer generation, that famously activist generation, and what you identify as, I guess, a different sort of silence and retirement that seems to have come into play around this group of people. Now, in terms of the kind of responsibilities for environmental activism in particular, this is something that you explore in the piece. I guess the question is, do those ideas of silence and retirement also have a different freight in 2020 in terms of the necessarily separated and isolated lives that a lot of us have been living across these past months?
That's an interesting one now. It's quite a challenging question now, I think. Before we'd had this experience of lockdown, which has gone really throughout the world, you might have thought, or I might have thought, it's good for an elder or a senior to stake out a place of quietness. And we all have role models who do that. One of mine is the American poet Wendell Berry, who's now in his 90s, who very much speaks from land and location and a pastoral life and has a kind of quietness about him. But I think when everyone is locked down, there's also a need to work against that. People need the energy and the dynamic of connection. And one of the themes that began to kind of develop as I was writing the essay is that this need for elders to play a dual role in a way of connecting in an enduring and peaceable way with the planet as a whole, but also you need the fire of the elder. You know, Blake's, the tigers of wrath are wiser than the horses of understanding. And the horse of the understanding in Blake's symbolism is an obedient creature who's trained to do things in service. And the tiger just operates off this fiery energy that drives it through life and drives it as a life force. Blake is a wonderful exemplar of a kind of moral anger, you know, writing in the late 18th century, which is the period I've had spent a lot of time with, when you did get these massive kind of revolutionary changes happening in America and in Europe and trying to happen in Britain and being clamped down. And then the spillover from that came here to Australia and was part of the settler foundations here. So much felt so profoundly and cruelly wrong to so many people that if you weren't angry, you weren't properly alive. And I think intermittently that comes back. You know, you said I study cultural change. That's what fascinates me endlessly and always has. It came back in the 60s, probably prompted largely by the war threat, the threat of nuclear war and the Vietnam War, which was affecting so many people of my age who were getting called up. But now I think we've got it again because of the planet and because this kind of ideology that we've been living off, this kind of economy first ideology, which has made us so banal and so cramped in our political life and so fraught, we can't have that anymore. I think a lot of us are feeling, no matter what, we just have to attack that with everything we've got, which is why Greta Thunberg comes into the essay. Mm. I just love the rage of that young woman. It's so wise. So, yeah, the quietness and the rage, I think, are equally important.
I want to come back to Greta a little later, because I think part of what's lovely about the essay is the way you bring together the need for both ends of the spectrum in terms of, you know, experience and youth in that way. But I want to stay with some particular voices now and introduce you, Andrew Stafford. Andrew is a freelance journalist, is the author of Pig City, a book about Brisbane, and Something to Believe In. And his piece for Getting On was an extraordinary piece of reportage called Dying Wish, Dementia and End-of-Life Choices. It was the first piece supported by our copyright agency Cultural Fund Reportage Project. Now, Andrew, you begin this essay with a visit to your mother, and you tell us very, very early on in the piece about a conversation that you had with your mum 4 years ago when she asked you to kill her, and you describe the situation that your mother has found herself in and through this, you know, the situation that you find yourself in, and the very complicated space that exists around the euthanasia debate on the one hand and people like your mum who are living with reduced capacity in a way. And you say very movingly, I think, that you know, you've sort of stumbled down the staircase of her decline with her, and you now find yourself looking over this very perilous edge into an incredibly complicated conversation. Can you talk to us a little bit about, I suppose, the micro of the space that your mum's experience has brought you to, and then the macro of this story that you drew together for us through all these different perspectives and voices in a very nuanced way?
That's also, thank you, Ashley. That's also a very big question. And I nearly literally broke my own heart trying to answer that in 6,500 words. I'll try to boil it down a bit. But so my mother, Sue, is now 73, only just, and she suffered from Alzheimer's disease for 18 years now. So she was an early onset sufferer. She started to experience symptoms in around 2002. For nearly 3 years now, she has been bedridden and effectively unable to communicate. I wouldn't say that she's nonverbal, but she's not able to actually verbalise her wishes or, you know, she has very few recognisable words, let alone being able to form a sentence. So, yeah, that's been a very difficult situation to effectively be part of and to bear witness to for a very long period, watching her decline. She's also been in aged care now for since early 2015, so we're coming up to nearly 6 years for her. She's been fortunate in the sense that she's been very well looked after in aged care, which is, I'm acutely aware, more than can be said for many other people's loved ones. And yet there is this tension in that my mother actually worked in aged care both at the coalface and then later in the bureaucracy at Queensland Health for many years. And she often described Alzheimer's disease to me personally as her worst nightmare. And this was years before it was actually visited upon her. So it's in that context that I related that anecdote about her asking me to kill her when she was really, you know, at this stage she'd just been admitted into aged care. She was beset by trauma. She still had, at that point, acute insight into her own condition. And, you know, this is not even a black sense of humour talking now to say that, you know, sometimes we might think that she's almost being looked after a little too well. It's actually, if anything, it's become, in Queensland at least, where we've been incredibly fortunate with regards to COVID relative to what's happened in Victoria, it's become very difficult for her to catch any of the, even any of the normal infections that might have shortened her life, which is what at this point she would have wanted. You know, she would not want to be in the position that she finds herself in now. But of course, she no longer, and has not had for many, many years now legally, any kind of capacity to express any wish for voluntary assisted dying if any such legislation had existed in Queensland at that time, which of course it does not. Anastasia Palaszczuk, the Premier, has just made a commitment that in the event of her re-election, she will be introducing voluntary assisted dying legislation to the next Parliament. There's been a long inquiry into that over the course of the past year, exploring many of the nuances and difficulties that you spoke to around this issue. And one of the most difficult queries that comes up is in relation to people with neurodegenerative disorders and reduced capacity and the ethics surrounding that and the extreme difficulty, the political difficulty, the ethical and medical difficulty of legislating in this area.
I think I'll
let you go again now, and if I didn't quite follow through or I lost the thread anywhere, you can point me in the right direction again.
No, I think you've absolutely brought it to precisely what defines this complexity, which is all these different prisms that need to be brought to bear in terms of legal, medical, ethical, religious, political, personal ideas. You have a quote from Andrew Denton, who's involved with the organisation Go Gentle, where you say that, you know, whenever he talks about this publicly, this is the number one thing that is concerning people. It feels like a sort of unnavigable space in a way, because everything is beset by so many variables and differences. It's fascinating to try to get your head around how these things might actively impact on one life, let alone how they can be brought into a kind of broader legislative space.
It's exceptionally difficult, and I think in a way it answers your question to say that I came out of the experience of writing this essay far less sure of my own opinions in relation to this matter than I was when I went in, and that's even in the context of the direct personal experience that I have with regards to my dear old mum. In terms of Andrew Denton's quote, we need to go back to some raw statistics here at this point. Dementia is now the second leading cause of death in Australia. It's the number one killer underlying cause of death for Australian women. I think it's the third leading overall cause of death for Australian men. We have something like 460,000 citizens of Australia currently living with dementia. And the cost, of course, of caring for people with dementia is enormous. And I'm not saying that to suggest that they are a drain on the national coffers, but I think what we're seeing is we now have, because we are living longer and we are getting sicker, and the getting sicker is partially, of course, a function of getting older, and we are starting to see, you know, obviously, I am just one of literally hundreds of thousands of similar stories where people are seeing their loved ones in a state of diminishing capacity and competence. And when we see that for ourselves, of course, for most of us, we have enough empathy to imagine ourselves in that position. Sarah Holland Batt, in another fine essay in this collection of Griffith Review, talks about, you know, our collective failure of imagination of what it looks like to become old. And when we see someone with dementia, we are directly seeing what our reduced capacity looks like and how that threatens to take away our own agency and our own ability to make decisions about what the end of our lives look like. It becomes very acute to us when we actually see that. And that's why these discussions, as difficult as they are and as politically unnavigable as they seem to be, are probably only going to increase in the course of the years and really the decades ahead. We have to look further ahead than that. This is going to be a very difficult issue for us to navigate. And I'm acutely aware of another quote of Andrew Denton's that might round this answer off, where, you know, a piece of legislation, no matter how good, no matter how sensitive or well written, there are always going to be very difficult cases that cannot be addressed by that legislation. There will always be people who are importing Nembutal, for example. There will always be people who take their own lives in, you know, grievous and difficult and tragic circumstances. Probably, you know, the best legislation in the world won't be able to account for, you know, all of the kind of variables. It might not ever be able to account for a case like my mum's. And yet Denton, as an advocate, was saying, well, of course, you know, politics being the art of the possible, we can't let the perfect be the enemy of the good either. And so, you know, we've now seen we've now seen two legislatures in Australia so far be able to pass voluntary assisted dying legislation in a very conservative form, and those two, of course, are Victoria and Western Australia. But other states, Tasmania, South Australia and New South Wales, have also held votes within the last decade, and all of those votes have been decided by just a single vote. So I guess what that tells you is that with a vote in the Queensland Parliament very possibly coming up within a year as well, there is momentum behind this discussion, and all of the polls will tell you that the wish for voluntary assisted dying or euthanasia or whatever you wish to call it at this time is practically overwhelming. So it's going to be one of the major, it already is one of the major ethical debates of our age, and that is only going to continue. That's going to increase.
I'm going to take us in a slightly different direction and bring Tony Birch into the conversation now. Tony has published short story collections and poetry and novels. His most recent novel, The White Girl, was shortlisted for this year's Miles Franklin Award, and he was awarded the Patrick White Literary Prize in 2017. Tony, your essay for us is called Things of Stone and Wood and Wool, Taking Comfort in Objects, and it is a meditation on your brother's death, on memory and on comfort, and it's part of a larger suite of work that you've been writing in response to your brother's life. In our piece, you say, I've written about this several times, with each essay building on the previous one, including conscious repetition, Perhaps you say, I'm not repeating myself, but engaging in the act of reiteration as a means of paying my respect to his life. Can you talk to us a little bit about the processes of revisiting and recasting your brother's story, and I guess the power and potential for that in terms of life going on in a way?
Yeah, for sure. One of the things that I think we all suffer this as writers is that, you know, you don't want to turn your family or your grief or your brother's death into material. So I was very conscious of that. And after Wayne had died, I felt an urge to write, but I also pushed it away because I felt that it would seem so exploitative to write about what had happened. And I'd found my brother dead in his flat and had been traumatic. What happened, I suppose, were two things. One goes very to the heart of your point of me commenting on reiteration and revisiting. I began by tracing a walk that we had enjoyed as children. So as people who know my writing know well, I've written a lot about the Birrarung, the Yarra River, and we've lived close to the river for most of our lives. And we spent our teenage years on the river, you know, most days of our lives, particularly on weekends for many years. And when I felt particularly immobilized over my brother's death, I traced a walk along the river, which was about a two-hour walk and about a 40-45 minute run. So I've been a runner for many years. And I did it once thinking that I needed to do a sort of a memorial walk, or being an old altar boy, sort of Stations of the Cross, and to revisit sites that were really important to us. And I did that walk the first day and felt really rejuvenated afterwards, because I felt that, yeah, the essence of him as a young boy and a teenager was brought back to me in that walk. And I left Dyke Falls and walked up to my mother's house for a cup of tea, who lives very close. This is in Collingwood, by the way, in Melbourne. And by the time I got to her house, I realised I had to go and do the walk again the next day. And then that night, lying in bed before I went to sleep, I traced the walk in my head and where I'd walked. And what happened over the next few months, I did the same walk either walking or running almost every day of the week. And what I was doing, I realized, was not trying to remember new events from our past, but just literally walk deeper into that past and feel more connected to him. So reiteration and repetition became central to the walk itself, and the walking was both therapeutic and it gave me license to initially write at a personal level. And then actually the second and relative point to that is that I did write a first essay, and I enjoyed the writing and I felt it was dignified and respectful, and I showed it to my mum. And I said, I'm not sure what to do. I said, I think I could publish this work, and what do you think I should do? And she said something very interesting, because my younger brother had suffered very serious psychiatric illness for about 40 years, and it changed him mentally and changed him physically. And I've alluded to in several essays that my younger brother was incredibly beautiful looking. I mean, people thought he must have been adopted, because the rest of us have really rough heads as kids. And he was so angelic and had this beautiful head of luscious hair and beautiful big brown eyes, and which my son and my grandson have both inherited, by the way. And my mum said, she read the essay and said, I think I would like people to know Wayne as he was before he got sick. Not that we're ever embarrassed or ashamed of that. We're a very open family. And people talking earlier, by the way, both Jane and Andrew, we're very open about issues of death and getting old in our family. So she felt it was important to tell his story so people had a full sense of who he was. So I found that I wrote several nonfiction essays. I have two books coming out next year, a book of poetry and a book of short stories. And there are several poems dealing with his life and two short stories that are fictionalized issues around his life. And it is interesting that I feel now that, well, when I say I've dealt with it, not dealt with my brother's death, but I've written enough or said enough in writing that I need to say about that experience. But I can't imagine now not having done the writing, or how I would feel having not done the writing. It has given me greater insight into myself, and it just rejuvenated my sense of how much I loved my brother, which I hadn't lost because we're a very close family. But I suppose I see the writing as celebrating love, and I'm I'm actually really pleased about that.
I don't want to interrupt Ash's flow, but just if I can respond to Tony, I've also grappled with some similar issues in terms of writing about and remembering Mum. Of course, unlike Tony's brother, Mum is still alive, but she's unable to give consent for me to tell her story. So that was something that I have at times ethically grappled with as well, you know. And that's been, you know, that's, I had to ask myself, is this something that she would approve of? Particularly when I've written about elements, including in this essay, about her losing her physical dignity. And I can't really say for sure how she would have felt about that, but I think she would have been pleased for me to advocate for her in some way. And I related to what Tony was saying about writing as an act of repetition and remembering as well. And Mum's been sick for so long now that it is actually hard for me to capture her as she was. I've often remarked that it might not be until she actually goes that I might be able to access those memories a little bit better.
I want to thank you, Andrew, and I want to stay with you, Tony, and with that idea of love that comes through incredibly strongly in your piece about your brother, and I think is also part of what Andrew's talking about in writing about his mum. I'm interested too. I see a particular link between this essay of yours and Jane's piece in a way. You write about a single stone which you choose as a memento at the funeral of a friend's father that you attend, and you talk about the guidance that this single soulless and inanimate object offers you. Now, I know in your nonfiction work, you know, you write at a kind of planetary scale in terms of climate emergency and climate justice. And I think there are some really interesting intersections between the space that Jane is exploring in terms of responsibility for these kind of planetary sized stories, but coming right back down to you and this single object and how it guides you in a way through not just the grieving but the living, I guess, and your own aging in a way, why you are determined that you still have more life to live.
Yeah, I mean, I was thinking of Jane talking about anger and elder people. I had the stone this morning, and I imagine this morning I could also throw it at someone sometimes. You can, not in the house, of course. We have a very non-angry house. But look, it's you're raising something that I personally really grapple with, because I'm in the problematic position of being a secular Aboriginal person, and we don't have time to go into that in detail. That brings up a lot of issues for Aboriginal people and can get you into a lot of trouble. And I value spirituality and connection to country vitally, because I see it as a means of Aboriginal people being able to articulate a deep relationship to country. I don't believe in the literal visitation of ancestors, for instance. I personally don't accept that for me. But the stone issue is so important, because it was at a funeral where I was asked to read a poem for a man I'd only met twice, but his daughter, who's a remarkable Aboriginal woman I've known most of her life, and her asking me to do that was something that I felt honoured to do. And they had this wonderful table of objects where they, and I hadn't seen this at a funeral before, where they asked people to take something home. And it was like a trash and treasure store at best. They're old paperback novels and old tools and stuff that, you know, people would love for a lack of material value, but I imagine having great emotional value. And as soon as I picked up this stone, its weight, it was quite heavy. It fits in the palm of your hand quite easily, but it was very dense and strong. And I literally did think, this is remarkably strong. And looking at it and thinking, the only way human society can destroy this is, you know, to explode it or to crush it under rock, but to use undue force. So in other words, I on my own could never, ever damage this stone. And it did make me think about, one, that it was important to be humble faced with that, and it was important to realize my place not being equal to the stone, but giving privilege to the stone. So I felt philosophically it was one of those moments in my life where, you know, you pick something up or you might be looking at a beautiful sunset, you might be walking along the bush and you just are in awe of what is around you and need to understand your place in it. Must be not only respectful of nature, not only respectful of the planet, but to give authority, to literally give authority to the planet. And I suppose as you talked about the bigger picture, it does go to what I learned in doing my fellowship on climate justice for 5 years, was that, you know, all of the stuff we need to do immediately, because we are in a climate crisis, I believe that while I regard it as centrally important, if we're really going to consider how we might live on this planet very differently as we need to, we need a generational, philosophical, and for some people, spiritual change. And if we don't change the way we see ourselves in relationship to the planet, I think we will eventually repeat the same mistakes we've made over and over again. And I have the stone upstairs on my bedside table next to the pine cone that I smuggled out of Kyoto that represents my brother, and they sit there together. And it's interesting because, yeah, the pine cone I could crush in my hand. I could break that up in my hand, but it represents my brother, and I like the notion of those two objects sitting together as reminders of things that I value.
I need to get in a sneaky spruik here because I'm very excited by the fact that we have one of the poems about your brother in our next edition of Griffith Review, which is out in November. And I love not just the conversations that happen inside each edition of the book, but the way different pieces speak across books. I'm really pleased we could give a home to that next little piece of your thinking around him in that way.
Well, I've been told I'm in your stable, Ashley.
I didn't know I had one, but I'm very happy to have you, Tony Birch. Jane, I wanted to come back to you and to pick up on where we sort of left off with the idea of Greta Thunberg and the sense that Tony is talking about here too of this need for generational change. One of the really powerful things that you do in your essay is to sort of hold Greta Thunberg in one hand and Lewis Lapham, who's the 85-year-old editor formerly of Harper's Magazine but now of Lapham's Quarterly. Just thinking about these two people sort of in balance, I wanted to ask you about how the two generations can complement and amplify each other, particularly in the space of climate justice and the climate emergency.
And one of the spurs for the essay was that I bought this issue of Lapham's Quarterly. It's actually on trade, and became then very interested in his history, because he told the story of his great uncle, which resonated with the story of my grandfather, which gets into the essay. But then I was looking at some subsequent issues, and the one on the environment includes a transcript of Thunberg's speech to the UN. And there was something about, I mean, Lapham writes a preamble to every issue, as you do, wonderful essays you write, actually, at the beginning of the issues.
Thank you, Jane.
Well, no, it's a real art, you know, because it's something more than just surveying what's in there. It's actually establishing a theme with a particular kind of language. And there was such a natural resonance between her voice and his. And, of course, it's not just across one generation. It must be across four generations. Mm. There's a huge difference. And there's a point at which Thunberg talks about being 10 years old and the attitude of the people around her to her future as a place of infinite possibility. And Lapham also talks about being 10 years old without referring to Thunberg. It's just something that's come up for him and his sense of his future and how the future that has transpired has really been so unimaginable from the point at which he was thinking of it at 10 years old. And it made me think it's very interesting to go back to the age of 10. I mean, just briefly, I also have a brother who has a lifelong mental health condition. He became the victim of an inherited schizophrenia when he was 18 years old. And thinking of him at the age of 10, he was a very unusual child, a bit preternaturally kind of intellectual, not always in a good way. I remember him reading Xenophon when he was in primary school and teaching himself Greek. And when he, 10 years later, at the age of 18, he got a scholarship to Oxford and the telegram came and he'd just gone down the road to catch the bus. I remember pelting down the road after him with his telegram in my hand and just missed him. He'd just got on the bus. Within a year of that, he'd been hit by this horrible breakdown, couldn't finish his degree, couldn't really sustain any, you know, romantic relationship. But I still see him every year. The last time I saw him was on his 70th birthday. He lives in England, so of course I can't get there this year. But it made me think, as Tony was talking, they talk about survivor guilt if you've lost a sibling in childhood. There's, I think, a version of that when you have a sibling who has really drawn a genetic short straw. You didn't draw it, they did. There's some extraordinary symmetry there. My brother and I are both Gemini. And sometimes I feel when I'm working on something, you know, why wasn't this his work? Well, maybe it has to be also his work. And I always talk to him. He has some of that extraordinary brain is still there. He has a formidable memory. And I try to always draw on something he's told me about or a conversation I've had with him in everything I write. Anyway, I've gone off piste, but back to you.
Thank you. Thank you for that. It does pick up, though, the next thing that I wanted to ask you about, Andrew, which keeping an eye on the time does leap to the end of your essay rather rapidly. You have this beautiful intersection, not with your mother, but with someone else who's a resident in the aged care facility where she lives. And it's this extraordinary sort of opportunity for connection and generosity. And if we are going to navigate this incredibly nuanced and complicated space, as Andrew Denton says, not let, you know, one thing get in the way of any sort of possible action we can take, those senses of connection and generosity seem to be what we're going to need. Can you talk to us a little bit just about the sort of, I guess, the emotion in a way of the space that you leave us with in the end of the essay, which is a very hopeful and warm place to end in?
I'm glad that was your interpretation of it. It wasn't necessarily mine when I was writing it, but I was very aware. I went very deliberately, I went to visit my mum in the days before I sat down to write the essay. And I don't see, you know, I probably see mum on average every few weeks these days, and I don't stay very long either when I see her, because there's no connection or engagement there at all. I cannot stress that enough. There's no memory left for mum. So really I'm going to make my presence felt, to let the staff know that I'm still around and that I still care and that I still am looking out for her. And also I thought, you know, I had in mind ahead of writing the essay that because I was bringing this personal experience to bear, I needed to describe her surroundings, I needed to describe again her setting and where she found herself and who she was. And I also thought, as a writer, that there might be something that came up that gave me some extra aspect of material. And I met another woman there who I'm very profoundly aware, I was very profoundly aware as soon as I walked out of that building, that she had given me an extraordinary writer's gift, as well as an experience I won't forget. She was probably a bit older than my mum in her, I would say, mid-70s or later 70s. And as I walked in, I could see her looking at me and as if she recognised me, which she could not have, but she was, I've come to know the look on the face. She was kind of looking for a match, as like, who's that? And she asked me if I was here to see anyone special. Of course I was going to see someone special. I was going to see my mum. And then I went to leave a little bit later, and then I realised, oh gosh, I've left my glasses in the room. So I went back in, buzzed myself back in, collected my glasses, and I was on my way out again when I bumped into this beautiful old lady. And that time she thought she did recognise me. You know, she had this big smile and she held her arms out to me, and I said, "Would you like a hug?" She said, "Oh, that would be just lovely." So I, you know, just decided not to shatter her illusion and say, "Oh, look, you know, I'm sorry, you must think I'm someone else." And I gave her a hug, and I was a bit distraught myself, and it was like, you know, for that moment, I'd let her be my mum, and I'd allow myself to be her son in that time. So, you know, it was a lovely moment, and I guess, you know, I hope I'm returning to your point, but I guess that was an act of empathy and generosity, as you say, and we need all of the empathy and generosity that we can muster in dealing with these issues, which are very difficult and very challenging and very provocative. And as I was saying earlier, you know, these issues are not going to be going away anytime soon either. So that requires a lot of love, I think, to be able to put ourselves in other people's shoes, and also to be able to imagine ourselves in the same position.
I want to stay with this idea of generosity and come back to you, Tony, and move a little bit beyond your stone. There is another gorgeous, well, there are several sections in the essay where you talk about almost a tradition that your family has when somebody passes away, that their belongings, their possessions are shared, they're gifted in a sense. And there's a beautiful scene where you describe yourself being in an op shop and seeing a lady you don't know pick up a vase that belonged to your nan, and you just see this look on her face as she enjoys it and sort of connects with it. There's something very powerful at play in the act of writing the essay and in these moments with the stone, with your brother's possessions, your nan's possessions, these ideas of inheritance and gifting. And I wonder if you could talk to us a little bit just about their importance as part of ongoing life, as part of the growth, I guess, in this idea of all of us growing older just by the act of, you know, keeping going and having our next day when someone else is not having theirs.
Yeah. I think I'm lucky. I come from a very large family, as does all my mum and my aunties and uncles. We're even luckier to come from very large, very poor families. So one thing that happens when someone in our families die is there's never any fight over the inheritance, because there is nothing of any material value to inherit. And the unfortunate outcome of my generation, me being well off in a relative sense, I'm a bit worried what might happen. So what has happened, I think, is that it's a wonderful mix of not being attached materially to a lot of stuff, so that when the night that my grandmother died, my mum being a bit determined to make sure everything is always kept clean, the night her own mother died, we were down at her housing commission flat scrubbing it and putting all the stuff out for people to collect. And yeah, we gave so much stuff away to people on the housing commission estate, they took everything. And yet there were very small objects that my mum said, pick stuff that you want. And I still have here at home, I have a little glass container that we used to put the tomato sauce in when we had tomato sauce with our homemade sausage rolls. You know, it's probably worth 50 cents. I do have a ceramic hot water bottle, which has some antique value, and a couple of other things. And we all have a couple of things. And what's interesting is, and it's not surprising, that the objects that we chose all have stories, experiences, and memories attached to them. So that's where the value comes from in those objects. But it's also the fact that in the sort of consumer material culture we live in, we realize we just have too much stuff. We have stuff that is of no relevance in the long term. So that I notice older people that I know these days who are, you know, relatively well off, as they get old, they start getting rid of a lot of stuff. And I think it's because they think, I don't want my kids to have to get rid of all this stuff. And I'm really interested in that relationship between objects. Is, in other words, what is it about a tomato sauce container? What is it about a tea cozy that holds value when something else you can give away is meaningless? Or it's about the meaning that we ascribe to objects. And it's about, I think, in our case, in our family, it's also about a strange, well, not strange, but being able to attach love to an object that had another life. One of the things that has always fascinated me from when I was a kid going to secondhand shops with my nan and my mum is the fascination of the life that these objects had before I took possession of them. Why did someone leave them in a shop? Who wore it? Who drank out of this cup? And I think it's interesting that as a fiction writer and my life as a fiction writer, objects play a huge role. So in The White Girl, you know, the whole love of that granddaughter and the grandmother takes place around a kitchen table, around a teapot, around a bathtub in the backyard. So all of these objects are where life happens. And I think I've been very lucky in my life and my family to know that what it is that keeps you connected with family, although the strength of objects that don't themselves have any individual or monetary value. You couldn't give this stuff away.
Thank you for that. I think that leads in a sort of lateral way to the last question, and unfortunately the last question for the conversation that I want to bring to you, Jane. Now, this is a bit tangential. It picks up on some of your work around ideas of cultural change and the space that you leave us in the essay in Griffith Review with the clarion call for radical work that needs to be done, and your idea specifically of returning to an idea of the commons, which is, of course, another very particular kind of inheritance and another very particular kind of gifting. This is something that I've thought about again through this year of change, and I wonder if your sense of the urgency and the necessity around this kind of particular space of work has also increased as we've navigated the conditions of 2020.
I think, yeah, the ground is shifting under all of us. And the book I wrote a few years ago, came out last year, called The Politics of the Common Good, has the word commonwealth at the centre of it, and harks back to the English Revolution and particularly to a leader called Gerard Winstanley, who talked a lot. He used this recurrent image, the earth as a common treasury. And the idea that every creature born of the earth has a right to subsistence from it. Now, if you're talking radical and talking truly radical in the sense of roots, we have our roots in the earth, that should be the roots of our economy. I mean, the Conservative Party leader, Theresa May, talked contemptuously about there is no magic money tree. By God, there is. It's the planet. And we're all responsible for it. And we all have a right to benefit from it. And we should all be working in its cause. I'm not interested in the terms left, right, and centre. I think they're absolute nonsense in our present environment. If you're not working for the common good, that is not a left idea. That is a fundamental ethical principle. If you're not working for it, who or what are you working for? If I've got any wrath in me as an elder, it's to insist on that question. Okay. Over and out from me.
I think it's good to end with a little bit of wrath. Thank you, Jane. Look, we have come to the end of our allotted time together today. Thank you to everyone who's tuning in from wherever they are. And my hugest thanks to Tony, Andrew and Jane for their generosity of thinking for us today. We've been really thrilled with the way this particular edition of Griffith Review, number 68, Getting On, has moved through the world. It's got a lot of wonderful voices and ideas in it. It's got beautiful fiction from writers including Laura Elvery and Sam Wagon Watson, poetry from writers including Young Dawkins, and a wonderful piece by Anna McGann about her uncle, the late Australian writer Andrew McGann. It's a great collection of words and ideas. I'd particularly like to thank Sydney Writers Festival for finding a way for us to have this conversation, even though we couldn't all be sitting together in Sydney. I hope we can be at some stage in the future. But thanks again, fundamentally, to Tony, Jane and Andrew for your words for us at Griffith Review and for your conversation with us today. Thank you all.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, please remember to subscribe to and rate our channel.